right. Now, Job chapter 32, we learn something that we have not been told thus far in this book. And it's an interesting detail that we may wonder why we didn't pick up on earlier. And that is that there have been other folks listening to all of this discussion. Other people have been present besides Job and his friends. At least one other person, and he's the young man that whose observations we're going to get acquainted with next here. I want to ask you to think about what that means first, and then secondly, how you would have felt if you had been, suppose there were kind of other people standing around listening. Did that add to the spectacle of the situation? Is that part of what Job has meant when he felt like people were watching him and so on? Did it in some sense contribute to the loneliness that he felt? Because here he is expressing this agony and only three fellows are saying anything about it. And are some of the people present here not friends, but spectators? The other night, we were over at a ball game, a high school ball game, and at halftime, I looked over here, and there's a whole bunch of people gathered around over here at the far end of the track over there, and it turns out that somebody was down over there. I never saw if it was a kid or a player or a spectator or what, but there was I'm pretty sure that not everybody around was real close family or friends to him. A lot of people gathered around, and they have to make an announcement for folks to get out of the way. You know, maybe that's part of what's going on here. I don't know. And if it did, how did that contribute to Job's feelings? That's first. Now, secondly, how would you have felt at this point? What do you think we've got settled now at this point in Job? We're familiar with Job's plight from Job chapters 1 and 2. We know how he felt about it from Job chapter 3. And we've seen something now of the way the enemy, the devil here, uses Job's friends to try him mentally and emotionally and spiritually by the arguments back and forth about what he should do about how he's feeling. And that really has been what Job, here's what you should do about what you're feeling, what you're going through. That's been the level of their discussion. So what do you think, if you've been standing there, what would you feel right now at this point?
If you were
standing there, you're not Job, you're not his friends, you've been listening, how would you feel right now? What has been explained to you? What conclusions would you reach? What would you be wanting to say at this point?
Change your friends.
Job, you need a better set of comforters, Job. That would be one thing. All right. That'd be probably good advice.
It's not really fair for us to say what we say because we know what's going on that none of them know.
All right. True. We know some things that they don't know.
And
that's
we know
a good
the
point.
End.
That we know the end, beginning and the end. That's a good point. Brian?
We get awfully hard on these friends, and they deserve it. But I keep looking back, I believe it's chapter 2, where they saw his grief, and when they come up, they don't even hardly recognize him. They weep, they tear their clothes, they throw dust on themselves, and they sit 7 days. So there's some care, there's some concern, there's some misapplied scripture.
Yeah, there's
but,
some.
But they do care, and that's why they were there. And to see the frustration in Job, because they don't see the whole picture, and frustration from them because they think Job is just being arrogant.
All right. Your point that they got involved, they got personally involved, that's one thing that a lot of people today would not do, isn't it, Russ?
When you watch a bank, you usually end up picking sides.
All right. Whose side are you on?
I think that's what the spectators end up doing.
All right. That may be part of it. This young man we're about to study is frustrated with all of them, though. I mean, he's just... Are there situations in life, and this is what I was, one of the things that I was hoping that, this is how I feel about it. Are there situations in life where a part of the frustration is there's not an easy explanation? We want point one, point two, point three, conclusion, and invitation. That's how we want these things handled here. Rule one, rule two, rule three. Now go out and do it. And are there situations in life where what God is doing and what the forces that are against Him are doing are beyond our view, and we're having to deal with the symptoms and we don't have all of the answers right then, and it's frustrating. You remember when your kids, when you were kids, for some of us, Barney, this, you and I, we have to have real good memories now to remember when we were kids. But remember when we were kids, when we were in our teen years, and our parents had to tell us no to some of the things we wanted to do, or when they couldn't allow it, and they couldn't explain it all to us right now. They just said, some of these days you will understand. And we had to live in the meantime. Remember how frustrating that was for us and them, probably. Well, that's sort of the way God is with His children sometimes. And that's part of the situation. And one of the questions that come up, that always come up with the study of Job is why is this part of the book here? There's some things about this young man personally that we might that might be helpful to us, and I want to try to diagram this introduction this way. There's the personal parts of this, and then there are this section's place in the book. A couple of observations that we might make about both of them. Now, personally, Elihu is—he will say himself—he is a younger man who has held his peace because he's had respect enough to think that experience and age and wisdom should certainly be heard before him. There's some good things about this young man, and this is one of them. He is a young man who is, I'll put it this way, the connection that he has with this story is not stated. We are not told that Elihu was counted among Job's great friends, maybe because of the age difference. We're not told that he was somehow a part of the community. We don't know whether he came to be here with some of Job's friends or whatever. So the personal connection in this story is not stated, and that's one of the reasons that I raise the question of whether he is involved in the hurting that's going on here some way, or whether he has seen friends gathering and a man suffering and has come to watch, whether he's heard some of the discussions and wanted to listen in. That part of it we don't know. We do know that what he heard ultimately made him angry. He'll tell us that himself. I like the way it's said in chapter 32 and verse 18. For I am full of words. That's how he said it. One of our little kids asked me one time, Bill, where do you get all those words? And maybe this was his text for that question. I don't know. This young man has, in other words, he cares about matters that involve God, and he cares about what's happening in this discussion here, and he's been provoked by it. He's angry about it. So that part of it, we know a little bit. You'll see this as we read some of this. He has a little bit of youth. I almost said useful. Youthful conceit here. And what I mean by that is he doesn't know any better. One of the situations with our youth is that we kind of are sure, more sure of ourselves than we ought to be about questions that have depth to them when we're younger. And we can stake out positions and offer explanations that we later look back on and are just slightly embarrassed by, because we can see that we oversimplified things a little bit. And you'll see a little bit of that in him. And you'll also see that this young man adds some things to this discussion. Now, there's good and bad in what he says. He'll restate some things that he says will sound a whole lot like what the friends have said to Job. But he adds some meaningful things to this discussion that we're going to want to see. And one of the things is that this is the young man who is going to say, God is greater than us. I think that begins to add to it. He's going to say, there may be some things happen that God uses for good. In other words, the friends have pretty much, I mean, they've hinted at that, but pretty much it's been, Job, God must be correcting you, or, you know, something like that. And Elihu is going to be among the first who's going to say there may be some things that God allows but doesn't cause. So you kind of watch that as we go along here. Now, also I want to mention about Elihu that he's the first person in this book who has a Hebrew name. I didn't realize that until I started working on this. He's also a young man, notice, verse 2 of chapter 32, who has just a little bit of genealogy about him. The others were told where they were from, and that would say, I think that maybe there is some connection with a family rooted in God or rooted in godliness here. It's also interesting that this young man, and maybe this other part I'll put over here, where does it fit in the book? And when I read about this, there are all kinds of things that are suggested or argued back and forth about why this is even here. In the first place, this serves as an interlude or a moment of transition between Job's claims and his friends' arguments and so forth, and when God appears to settle the issue. All right, this is all the discussion is ended. Nothing has been settled to anybody's satisfaction. The friends still have their argument. Job still is saying he has his integrity. And in that deadlock situation, this young man's words serve an important purpose in the book. And then the other thing is, this serves as a transition. This young man's word, what he says now will allow attention to begin to turn to God. It's been on Job so far. Casey, your assistance is required, I think. We enjoyed having you with us. Okay. Attention begins to turn to to God now at this point in the book. There's an interesting thing about this is that when God does appear, this young man, I'm going to put it up here this way, and maybe it will seem as odd to you as it does me. God has something to say to Job and about Job, and he has something to say to Job's friends and about Job's friends, but God says nothing at all about Elihu. And that strikes me as interesting. There is no hint of any response that either Job or his friends or God thinks of what Elihu has said. Maybe they're just taking it as commentary or something at that point. I do not know about that. But if we kind of take this in those ways, maybe it'll be helpful. Now, have I confused, or do you have other illustrations? Why this part of the book is here is a big part of any commentary or any works on Job that you can find. You'll discover that why this is here is a big part of the study. So I wanted to take a little time to maybe set the stage for us in that way. All right, now let's start to look at the text at this point here. Chapter 32, beginning, introduces him. All the Job's friends now have ceased to answer him. Chapter 32, verse 1 says, why?
Because there's no arguing with him.
I have no arguing with this man. I wonder why a wife would answer that question. Okay. Tim, you want to explain further? Okay, no. Because he was righteous in his own eyes, the ESV says in verse 1. And that's their opinion. They believe that Job has refused any correction. And then, now at that point, nobody is saying anything. Now Elihu... notice verse 2. Elihu is moved by what? He. This man, you talk about a fiery orator. He is set on fire by
anger.
Now, what's he angry about? Who's he angry with? Why? What does he have? What dog does he have hunting in this race here? All right, God. He believes this young man is a lover of God, and he believes, notice he burns with anger. He burned with anger at Job. Why?
Justifying himself instead of God.
All right, he justified himself, and Job does that. But this young man believes that Job, in the process of justifying himself, has accused God. Now, if you think about this, this fits in the view of this book in an important way. You have God, you have a man who is suffering, and a man who says he hasn't done anything to deserve this suffering. And in Elihu's thinking, what's the only other explanation here? All right, God is unjust, and that's where he believes that Job has justified himself instead of God. Now, he also burns with anger at Job's friends. Why?
Because they couldn't answer.
All right, because they couldn't answer. There's another part of what?
Condemned.
All right, he's angry with Job's friends because they had no answer for his claims, but they still found fault with him. They still condemned him. They still held him guilty. All right. Job justifies himself rather than God. His friends condemn Job with no reason. They haven't been able to convict him with anything. And so this young fella says he had waited to speak to Job because they were older than he. you admire that about him. He had some self-restraint and respect. And when Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, can you imagine the awkward silence after the words of Job are ended at the end of chapter 31? He looks around and he said, well, we can't just leave it here. Isn't somebody going to say something? So he does. All right. Notice that in verse 6, the discussion begins. And he mentions that he is young in years while they are aged. I was timid and afraid to declare my opinion. Boy, he gets over that quick here, doesn't he? He has an opinion that takes 5 or 6 chapters, if you notice that. And his attitude was, verse 7, let experience be heard first. You can tell he's from a different culture than American culture right there. In ours, youth is to be heard first. And verse 8, do you think in verse 8 that Job or that Elihu, Travis, read verse 8 for us so we can get to what I'm...
But it is the spirit in man, the breath of the Almighty that makes him understand.
All right, now what does he mean by the breath of the Almighty? When does somebody here have, for example, the English Standard Version with you? One of you? I'm gonna have to read. Mike, would you turn over in the New Testament to 2 Timothy 3 and verse 16 for us? I want to ask your opinion. I can't prove this, but I want to ask your opinion if there is a connection in thought here, and if this is one of the purposes that Elihu does serve. Now, if you think about it, the three friends have argued, one from religious experience, that would be Eliphaz, one from common sense, and one from justice, from the punishment of the wicked. And ask yourself, what's the basis of Eliphaz's reasoning? The breath, it's not in the spirit of man, but the breath of the Almighty that makes him understand. All right, Mike, 2 Timothy 3:16.
All scripture is breathed out by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness.
All right, now, I had him to read that version for the way that it translates the term that's always, I think, understood as inspiration. Did you catch it? All scripture is God breathed. All right, God breathed. Now, come back over to Job 32 and verse 8, and where does Elihu say that the answer is the understanding that we need has to ultimately be found? Eddie?
God.
All right.
But also in Proverbs 2 and 6, for the Lord gives wisdom, from his mouth comes knowledge and understanding.
Yeah. I know there are several passages like that in Scripture, but I'm not arguing here that Elihu necessarily understood everything about inspiration or whatever, but he does turn our attention, if you think about it, gently to the idea, maybe it's gently, to the idea that there are some things that God can only answer. And there are some things that inspiration, the breath of God, is going to have to be behind. Now, I'd like you to at least have that thought in mind as we watch the transition from chapter 31 to chapter 38 take place. Now, he says in verse 10, verse 9, as a result of the fact that the Almighty, the breath of the Almighty gives understanding, it's not then the aged or the the many, the one who are many in years, who are wise, understand what's right. In other words, what he's getting at is, if God gives the answers, a young man can provide them in some cases too, because if they come from God. That's his point. All right, now, verse 11, I waited for your words. I listened. Look, notice he uses for and not two. All right, is that a significant thing to you? He doesn't say, I listened to your words and I listened to your wise saying. Your wise saying, I listened for them. Well, he says, while you searched out what to say. Now, what does that imply? All right. He's listened to how many chapters? From 3 to 31, that many chapters, and he hadn't heard. He hadn't heard what he's been listening for yet. I gave you my attention. He's talking about how they searched out what to say. But he says, behold, there was none. What? Verse 12. There's none among you who refuted Job or answered his words. So what is he angry about? They've let Job talk without providing any answer for him. No response, no satisfactory response to words. So he scolds them about the lack of wisdom that they have supplied. This would tie the discussion to Job 28 and what Job said about wisdom, by the way. Now they've been dismayed. Verse 15, they answer no more. That describes exactly the situation. There's a silence that fell over them, and this young man is speaking because of that. So now he says, verse 17 and 18, I want my turn. I want to answer my share. I'm full of words. The spirit within me constrains me. In other words, I can't help but say these things. I can't not say these things. My belly is like wine that has no vent. Remember, wine was kept in a wineskin in those days. And as it would ferment, or if it did, it would swell and swell until it popped.
Expand.
It would expand and so forth until it burst. And that's how this young man is feeling. He's got this. I must speak, verse 20 says. And verse 21 is like fair warning. What does he say? I will not show partiality to any man or use flattery toward any person, for I do not know how to flatter, else my Maker would soon take me away. Is there something to admire in that last statement or to criticize? To smile at. All right.
That's where the youth comes from.
All right, it is for also human nature and youth combined right there, don't they? He's giving them fair warning here. You talk about taking sides. He hadn't found a side that he wants to be on, so he's going to pour it on both. So let's start with Job, verse 33, or chapter 33. And you think a little bit about this, if you notice any arrogance in this. Yeah, a man sitting there on the ash heap, we assume he still is, after all he's been through, and, but now hear my speech, O Job, and listen to all my words. I'll open my mouth, the tongue in my mouth speaks, my words declare the uprightness of my heart, and what my lips know, they will speak sincerely. All right. Admire that so far, I guess. Now, verse 5, notice that he turns attention to the Spirit of God and the breath of the Almighty, which made him and gives him life, and asks Job to answer him if he can. He's going to take up the arguments where these men have left them off. The young man says, I'm toward God as you are. I too was pinched off from a piece of clay. Verse 6, that's the ESV. That's a vivid little term there. And it adds some perspective to the young man's words that you have to admire. No fear of me need terrify you, verse 17. My pressure will not be heavy upon you. He's reassuring Job. He's speaking from a perspective of a God-fearer, and he's going to try to be kind and reasonable to Job. The fault that he finds with Job in verse 9 is, you say, I am pure without transgression. I am clean, and there is no iniquity in me. Now, the only thing I would say about that is, at least as I have understood Job, he has maintained his integrity in the sense that he has not done anything that would deserve this kind of agony and this kind of punishment. It can't be regarded as justice as far as Job can see in that way. The young man thinks, though, that Job is claiming absolute sinlessness. Verse 10, he says that Job has said that God finds occasions against me and counts me as his enemy. Job did say that sort of thing, but what is the young man leaving out there? He's leaving out the fact that Job was talking about how he felt right then while he was going through this. Job was not engaged in a theological argument. Job was talking about his own suffering. And he felt like he was a man who cried out to God and God didn't answer him. And he felt like a man that God had hunted down and was allowing or causing harm to come on you. Be honest, you ever feel that way? It's not your theology, but do you feel that way? Sometimes people do. And that's the idea. Now, verse 12, notice. Behold, in this you are. You're not right. Which is a way of saying, you are Job, you are flat wrong. And it, notice that his answer is, and this is where I say there's some transition occurring here. He says, why is Job not right? Is it because God is always just? Is it because people reap what they sow? Is it because we've always heard that what will happen to the wicked when he sins? Is that Elihu's answer right here? What does he say?
God is greater.
God is greater than man. Isn't that a huge part of the message of this book? This is the first time, so far as I know, that this thought has been brought up in this book. And which means that now for the first time, attention is being turned away from what Job is suffering and how justice gets worked out in the world and what Job ought to do now to the fact that God may be doing something greater than we know. And so that's an important... Now, finds fault with Job for, notice verse 13, why do you contend against him? And why do you think God should answer a man's words? Why do you think you ought to be able to haul God in court and to insist that there be an umpire or a judge between the two of you and for you to litigate your case against God? That's what Elihu finds fault with him. He says that God can speak, God may speak and different by different means. He may speak in a dream, verse 15 said, to turn a man aside from his deeds. He may, in speaking this way, keep the man's soul back from the pit, verse 18. Or verse 19, the man may be rebuked with pain upon his bed. I wish I had time to finish this chapter, which I meant to do, but I think that was the second bell. Just observe for me that what Elihu has done is to introduce the thought that God is greater than man and that he may allow suffering for two reasons. This is what we've not heard so far. On the one hand, he may have positive purposes. He may be turning a man away from a bad choice or turning him back from one. Or he may be rebuking a man for a choice already made. Now, we have a perspective on Job's experience we haven't had yet. This might be something that God allows not because he's angry with Job or not because he's punishing Job, but because he has Job's best interest in mind. Now, at this point, Elihu has introduced the thought. Now, the problem is, if you'll notice, that's not the only thing he has to say to Job. And that's not the only thing he has to say to Job's friends. Start here in the middle of chapter 33 for next week at verse 19 and read down through 37, and we'll try to summarize this discussion in next week's class. Appreciate you guys being with us. Have a great Lord's Day and a good week.